So, Jack, what are you currently up to, and what do you currently have going on right now with the band?
Well, right now we're enjoying the last 3 months of incredible reviews all over the world for Lance the Dead, and I actually started writing some new songs for the follow-up album, which is going to be killer.
And the songs you're writing for the follow-up album, how are they different? Well, how do they compare to the songs from The Land of the Dead?
I mean, like, how does Land of the Dead compare to them?
Yeah.
Well, you probably get sick of hearing this because every band always likes to, blow smoke up everyone and say how great the new album is, blah blah blah. And I've never done that in, like 30 years of putting out albums, but this time I really do have to say this album happens to be the best album I've ever put out, and I've put out about 20 albums.
Are you talking about the one that's upcoming or the one you just put out?
Just the one that just came out, Land of the Dead.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that one.
Well, I totally appreciate that. Yeah, there's just something about that album. We just really worked really hard to do it, and it paid off. And we had a good team. It wasn't, just Jack Starr making it great. It was me, three other great players, a great producer named Bart Gabriel, a great recording engineer named Marius Pietka in Poland. One of the best drummers in the world, Rhino. One of the best singers in the world, Todd Michael Hall. One of the best bassers, Ned Maloney. I really could just go on and on. And one of the best album artists in the world, Ken Kelly, who you might recognize from Kiss Destroyer and Rainbow Rising. And a record company that was willing to really put out a quality product. I mean, they put out a beautiful package with a 16-page booklet, and they just spared no expense, and they were totally behind us. And every time we kept going over budget, it was like, "Don't worry about it, just make an incredible album."
Now, I agree with you with this being your best album because I've listened to all of your past works, and this is by far the best thing I think you've ever done. And what is it to you? For example, what jumps out to you about The Land of the Dead that makes it your favorite album that you've ever made?
Well, here's the thing. I think that a lot of albums are very controlled. They're very monotone and static, and the producers tend to squash the life out of a lot of albums because they're so worried about everything being in perfect time and every solo being perfectly planned out to the, nanosecond. This album, I encouraged, since I'm pretty much, the leader of the band, if there is a leader, but I pretty much encouraged everyone to really just go nuts. Play like your life depended on it. If you're a great drummer, prove it. And, Rhino didn't really need much encouragement, but I unleashed him. I said, you've been on a lot of albums, and, you had to play, meticulous and very controlled, and you had to, play a certain way that the producer wanted. On this album, I wanted him to go balls out and do like incredible intros to the songs and play, just unexpected stuff, And same thing with Todd on vocals. I wanted him to push the limits of his voice. It wasn't enough that he's got a really great classically trained voice and, he's got at least 4 octaves. I wanted him to sound angry and passionate and pissed off. And so I think that that's the kind of the secret to this album. We're playing power metal, but we're playing it like we mean it.
So the guys decided to start touring, and any plans for any type of touring worldwide, maybe around here in the States, and any plans to play any shows anytime soon?
Decided to do a show up in Baltimore next month for an organization called Fallen Blue. is going to be the former drummer from Twisted Sister, AJ Perro. Also, the guitar player in a band called Zebra. I don't know if you remember them at all.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, they were a New York band, and he's going to be there. And so we're supposed to do this benefit to help police officers that were killed, you know, in the line of duty. So that's something that's planned. Also, I'm supposed to make an appearance at the Keep It True Festival in Germany in May. So, you know, this thing's going on. And as a band, we also have some festivals that are booked for, unfortunately, for 2013. We don't have anything really planned right now as a band. But I think really the philosophy is this. For this album to generate as much hype and noise and goodwill as possible, and then to be on a higher rung on the ladder than we would be if we just went out now. I don't know if that makes sense to you. In other words, we could go out now, but we wouldn't be playing the gigs that we want to play.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that if this album continues to generate momentum and just the incredible reviews that we've been getting, I think we will be asked to do, you know, better festivals and better shows and get paid more so that it makes sense for us to take our band to Europe, because unfortunately a lot of this business, you know, comes down to the money aspect. And, you know, we don't mind not making money if we're going to play in front of a lot of people, but it's hard to actually lose money.
Mm-hmm.
So not making is one thing, losing is another, and then of course the ultimate is you actually make money. What a concept, right?
Yeah.
Well, and here's the thing. I think this album is great, and to be honest with you, nowadays especially, it's really hard to get noticed. And with so many bands putting out so many releases, I could tell you right now, last year I had about 300 releases come at me, and it was really difficult to be able to listen to all of them, and your album was not one of them. In fact, I didn't discover the Land of the Dead album until one day I was just listening. It's really weird. I was listening to some of your older records, and then you contacted me, and I wasn't even aware you had an album out, and I'm usually aware of quite a bit, but it just, there's so much stuff out there. And do you think it's harder for a band to get noticed these days? Do you think it's harder for bands to be able to make a name for themselves? And at the same time, you know, this album gained you a lot of notoriety, and it got a lot of press and a lot of praise. And did this album help gain a lot of momentum for you, you know, say as an artist?
Honestly, it really started off strong right from the start. I mean, the first week it was out, there was already like 300 or 400 websites that were actually pirating it. And I mentioned that because that's always a good sign. When people think enough of your music to steal it, it's great. Not great for the record companies, not great for the musicians, but it's a great harbinger. It's a great sign of things to come. And literally, when that album came out, man, there were so many file-sharing places from Russia, from India, from China, from every Eastern Europe country you could think of. Literally, I mean, the next day it came out, it was everywhere. And in a weird way, I think it actually helped spread the news of this album. And the other thing is, just the reviews were just so incredible. I mean, with Defiance, we got okay reviews. That was the album before this one.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't enthusiastic. You know, it's kind of like if you see a girl and, she's nice looking. You say, oh, yeah, you know, she looks cool. But then you see another girl and it's like, damn, that girl's hot.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, then you know you've really lost your mind.
Yeah.
Well, also, here's the other thing, is that when I first, this record had a big impact on me, and I'm going to be honest with you, when I first heard it, the one thing that was, you know, usually when I gauge a good record, if the first couple tracks are so good that you can't stop listening to them before you get into the rest of the album, that's a good record, because I end up liking the rest of the album usually when something like that happens. And with Land of the Dead, I like the first song so much, I just kept repeating it over and over again. And, you know, with the musical chemistry, in my opinion, I think is very, very good. And these guys seem to work well together. And I really think you have something good going here, especially compared to your older stuff. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, you know, it's just basically, you know, we all like each other as people. And I think that's important. I mean, you know, Todd's a great guy. He's a straight shooter. He's an honest guy. He's not on an ego trip. I mean, he can sing as good as anybody out there. He really can. But if you talk to him, you'll never hear any kind of egotistical statements from him whatsoever. Same thing with Rhino. He can play, you know, drums as well as anybody out there. There's no doubt in my mind. Another very, very modest guy. And everybody in the band is like that. So I think that helps, that we like each other. And so when we get together to play, we're all having fun, and we're all on the same wavelength, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody in the band that will say, hey, man, you know, we got to tune the guitars down to low key and start singing in, you know, cookie cutter, you know, those Cookie Monster vocals. You know, like, I want to kill your mother, you know, whatever. I mean, we all like the same things, you know. We're liking power melodic metal. So that's important.
Jack, one of the things that is different about my show nowadays is that, you know, whereas before I had a lot of older people that used to listen to it, now I have a lot of younger people. I have a lot of people and their kids. I have kids in high school. I have young college kids that listen to the show now. Whereas before, most of the audience was a core metal audience that had been around for a while. And, you know, I have to ask you this. You came up in the infancy of the metal scene here in the States back in the early 80s, and it's always great to talk to people that have been around because there's some history to be shared there. And for all the younger listeners especially that don't know what it was like, say, 25, 30 years ago, talk a bit about what the metal scene was like for you when you were coming up, just starting out in Virgin Steel.
That's a good question. Well, you know, as you can imagine, you know, the scene was dramatically different. First of all, there weren't 300 metal albums that were being put out per year. It was more like 30. And also, there was a sense of discovery. You know, we were doing things that later on, 20 years later, became cliches. Like, I'll give you an example. My son used to like this band Hammerfall when he was like 13 years old.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember Hammerfall.
Oh, I know all about them.
Okay. So one day my son, Matt, wrote them a letter. And the guy was nice enough, the singer, I think Joaquin or somebody,
mm-hmm.
He was nice enough to write him back. And he said, by the way, is your dad Jack Starr? My son wrote him back. And he said, man, he goes, you know, you should be really proud. Out of the Darkness is one of my favorite albums. And, you know, your dad plays great, and Red Forrester, the singer on that album, you know, the former Riot singer, is one of my favorite singers. And then my son, you know, was asking me, wow, that's so cool, you know, here's a new band from this generation, you know, liking your band. And I was trying to explain, you know, without sounding, you know, like full of myself, but that some of the things that we laid out in Virgin Steel 1 became part of the lexicon, part of the dictionary of cliches of power metal. And I'll give you an example. The song Children of the Storm, which is on Virgin Steel 1, that song was the first song that I've heard of that actually had that kind of Viking chanting in the middle of the song where it goes, whoa, whoa, mm-hmm. You know, it does this thing. That's now using that in songs, you know, where the band does this kind of, you know, Viking chant sing along thing. That's like a cliche. Like hundreds of bands have used it, but when we did it, to the best of my knowledge, we were the first band that did that.
Yeah.
We were also the first band, to the best of my knowledge, in power metal that had an intro totally taken from a classical composer. The intro to Danger Zone is actually Minuet in G by Bach. And this was before Inge's album even came out. This was before Rising Force. So what I'm saying is that, and I'm not just saying our band was the only one that was cutting edge like that, but we were definitely at the forefront of that, and the things that we pioneered became cliches. And not just musically, and other things too, lyrically. You know, singing about different gods and about, heroic type, lyrics. Not, necessarily, not satanic like a band like Venom, but heroic. So, I mean, back then it was just Manowar and Virgin Steel that were doing those kind of lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, that was it. And the other bands that were metal bands were doing, what they could have been doing introspective kind of lyrics about alienation, like, Metallica did a lot of those. And but we were doing a lot of lyrics about the struggle to establish, your sense of self and your sense of perseverance and not giving up. And it was kind of like a Conan the Barbarian, that which does not kill us makes us stronger.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were, we were kind of embodying that. So I don't know if I got a little long-winded there, but you know what I'm trying to say, right?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, too, is that most of the bands that came out around the time you started out were all pioneers. I mean, much of what was going on back in those days, really, nobody was really doing a lot of that stuff. I mean, all this stuff was new. And, you were a part of the fact that you were doing something brand new and different.
Yeah, there were just very, very few bands that were doing what we were doing. And the ones, there were a lot of them that were trying, but even putting out an album was a major, major thing because nobody was, pressing their own CDs like people are today. Back then, you were trying to get record deals, and the thing that helped us the most was Mike Varney from Guitar Player Magazine. He started a label called Shrapnel,
mm-hmm.
and he picked me to be on his Guitar Heroes album, Unsung Guitar Heroes, Volume 2. And that album featured, Marty Friedman from Megadeth, and Michelangelo, and Dave Feinstein from The Rods, and just all kinds of people. And so by getting our foothold with that album, it put us in the stores, in all these little mom-and-pop heavy metal stores all over America. And then when our album came out, a lot of metalheads made the connection. Hey, that's Virgin Steel. That's the band that had the guitar player that was on that U.S. metal album, the Guitar Hero album. So even though we don't know who this band really is, Virgin Steel, they've got a cool name, they've got a cool album cover, and the guitar player's got to be decent because he made it onto that Guitar Hero album. So I think I'm going to buy it.
Well, nowadays, too, you have a lot of bands that, that do a lot of the things that have been done before and mix a lot of those elements in. But back when you started out, all of this stuff was brand new. And almost every band at some point, most of the major bands that came out back in the early 80s, 80, 81, 82, they were big influences on what was yet to come on the metal scene, and what they did set the tone for the next 30 years. It's just, most people don't realize that.
No, absolutely not. And that was the beauty of it, because there was a sense of innocence. We didn't have rules. We didn't have the cliches. And we were just trying stuff and see if people liked it. And, we were very lucky. Virgin Steel One came out on about 6 or 7 different labels. I can't even remember them at this point, but there was Music for Nations and in England, there was Roadrunner Records from the Benelux countries. This was before Roadrunner became a huge international company. Back then, they were just centered in Holland and Belgium. So we were on those two labels, plus we were on King Records in Japan, plus we were on Cobra Records. Records in Canada. Plus, we were on Burnett Records through CBS in France. Did I name six yet? I think we were on at least six or seven labels on the first one.
Yeah.
And so it was just a really great time, you know, to be doing this stuff.
Well, obviously, the music business and the music scene itself has changed in the last 25, 30 years, and there's been so much going on. I mean, so much negativity, you know, towards downloading. You have people that, you know, most record labels don't send out CDs anymore. They send out digital releases or digital press kits. And, you know, for you as a musician, you've been through all of this, and you've seen all of this from the start all the way till now. And, you know, what are some of the good things that you think have happened because of the digital age? And, you know, obviously there's some bad. You know, what do you think as an artist are some of the bad things?
Well, I think, you know, that's a good question, too, because there's really a lot that is good. Like, I think just the mere fact that the average musician can have access to recording equipment now. That didn't exist 30 years ago. Just to get your foot in a recording studio, you had to be really good. Today, anybody can go into Guitar Center and buy an 8-track recording machine for like $500, you know, and if you have, you know, some aptitude for electronics, you could figure out how to use it and actually record your band or your friend's band, you know. You could not do that in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
You had to pay at least $50 an hour and go into a studio. So already that eliminated a tremendous amount of people, because bands don't have money, so you have to find somebody that thinks you're good to pay for your recording and to pay for your equipment and so on and so forth, you know. So it weeded out a tremendous amount of people. You really did have to be good to put out albums back then.
Mm-hmm. What a lot of people don't realize too, back in the day, $50 was a lot more money, and also analog tape was not cheap. I mean, it was about $150 a reel. You only got 8 tracks, and you only got 15 minutes in each reel, so you had to buy a ton of tape just to be able to make a record before you even went into the studio to even start recording the record to begin with.
That two-inch Ampex tape, which we personally must have used at least 200 rolls of, is very, very expensive at $150 a pop, man. And I mean, you know, do the math. It's over 20,000 in just tape alone, and that's for, like, you know, I'm talking about for over the course of like 4 or 5 albums. But still, it's tremendous, and it's heavy, and it was tough to do editing on, because you actually, you know, would have to have an engineer that knew how to cut and splice tape, and you'd see tons of that stuff on the studio floor, you know, when you were doing an edit, and yeah, it was just difficult. But now the bad part, did I say the good part? Hold on. The good part being the access that everybody has. The bad part of the revolution in the music thing, I think, is that because there's so much product, it does make it harder for a new band to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a guy like myself, I mean, a lot of people, whether I'm a household name or not, you know, I don't think I'm a household name, but I think I'm fairly well known, where there's a lot of people out there that have heard of me.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it easier to put product out. But for a new band starting out and having to compete with, you know, 300 or 400 releases or 500, you know, whatever it is, I think it's harder.
Well, Jack, one of the things that bothers me, not only as a musician, but also bothers me as far as, you know, yeah, as a musician, but not only that, but it bothers me as a fan, is that many bands just don't practice the way they do. And with today's technology, you can go into the studio and you can make yourself sound much better than you actually are. And I've always been a firm believer that you put down on record what you're capable of doing as a musician. And, you know, a lot of people don't do that. And you see a lot of bands, they suffer in the live setting. And people just don't practice the way they do. And back when you had to record on tape, I mean, you had to have this stuff down, and you had to be able to play it. And if you couldn't, it wasn't going to come out right. And it just, you could, there was no type of trickery back then. And, you know, do you think this is a bad thing? And do you see the digital age as possibly, you know, bringing out musicians that really, you know, people just aren't as good?
I think that's a very good point. I think there's a lot of studio trickery going on today. And a friend of mine put it this way. He called it chicanery, which I thought was a funny name. He called it studio chicanery, you know, meaning just trickery and just like, you know, you take a guy that's a half-ass guitar player, but if you can edit the solo 20 times in a 45-second solo, you can weed out every bad note, and you can, you know, you can have the producer create a decent solo. But back then you couldn't, because nobody had that kind of budget. You know, you had to play a decent solo. You had maybe two or three shots at playing a good solo, and that was it, because it was too expensive.
Yeah.
I remember one time when we were recording Virgin Steel 2, which that particular album, you know, our budget went, you know, from like a non-existent budget to, I don't know, maybe $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000, somewhere around there. And I remember one time, you know, I'm in the studio and I'm, you know, stressed out because I'm not getting the solo quick enough, and I didn't want to, you know, people accusing, you know, me of, you know, taking up the whole budget, you know. And then the engineer, you know, comes up to me, he goes, you know, Jack, why can't you be like Ritchie Blackmore? You know, he comes into the studio, because they were doing their album in the same studio we were doing the album. He comes in, you know, he has a glass of wine, he relaxes, he doesn't get stressed out. And I'm saying, well, there's a big reason why I can't be like Ritchie Blackmore, because he's got a $100,000 budget to do the album, and we've got about $15,000. He can, you know, he can order food in, and, you know, whatever, and order some really nice, beautiful wine, you know, and you know, do all this stuff. And you know, that was the problem. You know, we were on a budget.
Yeah.
A little bit earlier, you told me about recording an album with your fiance, and talk about what that's going to entail, and talk a little bit about that project coming up for you, and give us some details on it.
Well, you know, I've always liked, you know, to do projects with female singers. I just think they have a cool perspective, you know, sometimes on metal and on rock. And also, there's something sexy about hearing a woman sing, you know. It's just like, wow, this is cool. Beverly's just got one of these voices that, you know, is very, very hot. And so I didn't even know she could sing. I mean, we were going out for months before she even told me she could sing. And so we've just been laying some tracks in the studio, and it's coming out really, really good. And we're going to try to put it out and do some videos too, because it's a visual thing as well. Chris has got great stage presence, so we're going to put out some videos and an album, and I think we'll have some interest in some of the metal labels.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be a side thing, but you know, you never know, because sometimes in life, you know, you do a side thing, and then the side thing has a life of its own and does really well, and you know, like a lot of band members today, you know, do more than one project.
Jack, it's been a lot of fun to be able to speak to you, and I'll tell you what, I really like your new album. I think that you put out a great record, and I have to tell you, Jack, that I'm really excited about airing this interview, because it was a lot of fun, and you have a lot of knowledge. And like I do with all the bands that I interview for the show, do you have any last words or any last things to say to all the metal fans that will be listening to this interview when I air it?
Well, my last words, you know, and this kind of takes me back a really long time. I remember we were being interviewed by Mark Schneider, who was Dee Schneider's brother, who had a radio show. This was a long time ago in New York. And he asked us the same question, you know, do you guys have any last words? And I was just being all, you know, intellectual. Well, we want to say, you know, this album, you know, combines the classical and this and that, you know. And, you know, I was just trying to be smart. And our drummer at the time said, buy this album. Listen to this album. It is a great album. And I was thinking, what a dopey thing to say. But 30 years later, I'm thinking, you know what? Joey is Asian. The first drummer of Virgin Steel was right. And so I would like to quote him and really tell your listeners, Tony, that I really believe this is a great album. Make it a point to listen to Land of the Dead by Burning Star. Listen to all the songs from, you know, the first track to the last track. If at all possible, buy it. It's available. It's all over the internet, you know, on Amazon, on CD Universe. It's actually in the major stores, too, like Barnes & Noble's, FYE in the mall, Best Buy. It's all in their computer, so even if they're temporarily out of it, you can order it through any of those stores or through any of the internet, you know. And I really want to stress this, too. I've never plugged an album in over 30 years of making albums. I've never, ever said anything remotely like a shameless plug, like, buy this album, go listen to it. But I am saying it on this album because I believe that MP3s, the stuff that, you know, that is free of charge, that we can all get from any artist all over the internet, I don't think it sounds anywhere near as good as buying the CD. And I think that if somebody actually buys this CD, like they have, and I've been getting, you know, people all day long on Facebook telling me, you know, that they bought it and it's great. If they buy this album and bring it home and listen to it in their car or in their stereo, this album really sounds at least 10 times better than the MP3s that they're playing on the internet. So that's really what I have to say. It's a good album, and I think as far as power metal album, you know, as far as that genre of music, I think we really delivered the goods.